Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. So, this week, we are coming to you from my home office in Los Angeles, about a week into self-isolation. We figured now is as good a time as any to look back at some of our favorite Bullseye interviews. So, a 2018 conversation with the great Boots Riley. Boots is hands down one of the most interesting people making art today. Among other things, he's the frontman of The Coup, one of my favorite rap groups of all time. The Coup make straightforward music. The beats never had a lot of frills. Boots, when he raps, does so plainly. But the central element of The Coup is its message. Boots told stories when he rapped, painted pictures from his real life. He talked about social justice and poverty and racism. A lot of hip-hop is about prosperity, overcoming a system that's been rigged against you for centuries. Success stories, in other words. The Coup, with Boots as the frontman, want to throw the system out entirely.
This is my resume / resignation, a ransom note with proposed legislation, a fevered ultimatum. You should take it verbatim, because I got two banging pieces and you don't want to date them. Flying kites.
About 8 years ago, Boots started working on a movie, something he'd never really done before. He started telling friends about it, asking acquaintances in the industry for advice. Sometimes he'd just corner a movie producer for 15 minutes. He wrote a screenplay, and thanks to a combination of audacity, determination, and luck, he actually made the movie. It's called Sorry to Bother You. It's set in Oakland, in a kind of alternate reality. Lakeith Stanfield is the star. He plays Cassius Green, a black man who gets a gig doing telemarketing. And it's in that job that he finds the key to success. Do a dead-on impression of a white dude, and magically, people listen when you call. From that point forth, it gets weirder, much weirder. If you've seen Sorry to Bother You, you know what I mean. But if you haven't, I don't want to spoil anything for you. I'll just say that it has elements of sci-fi and horror and more. But it's great. It's an instant classic. Let's take a listen to a little bit from the beginning of the movie here. Cassius is just getting started in telemarketing, and he can't seem to get the time of day on the phone. And in this scene, he gets some advice from a veteran coworker, played by Danny Glover.
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Any white is just proper. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the real deal.
Okay, so like...
Hello, Mr. Everett. Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother you.
I mean, you got it wrong. I'm not talking about sounding all nasal. It's like sounding like you don't have a care. Got your bills paid. You're happy about your future, you're about ready to jump in your Ferrari out there after you get off this call. Put some real breath in there. Breezy, like, I don't really need this money. You've never been fired, only laid off. It's not really a white voice. It's what they wish they sounded like. So it's like what they think they're supposed to sound like. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Boots Riley, welcome back to the show. It's nice to see you.
Good seeing you too, man.
I feel like the last time you were on the show, it was, I think it was a live show in San Francisco. And that was a long time ago.
Yep.
I'll say 6 or 7 years ago anyway. And you were working on this movie.
Yep.
This was like, why did you even think, how did you get the temerity to think that you, a grown man with a full career in another field, you know, a 20-year, 25-year career in another field, could change lanes like this?
Well, I guess it's because when I decided I was going to rap, I didn't know how to rap either.
But I mean, the difference is like when you decide you were going to rap, you were 17 or whatever, or 15.
No, I was like, 19 or 20 or something
so
like that.
Yeah, so everybody thinks they can do everything when they're 19.
I still think I can do everything. But I don't think I have the time to figure it out for everything. But yeah, I think because of that career, the idea that I know that there are steps to figure out with how to do things. I've done things that are hard before, you know, so I knew this. But I started out in film school before I was known as a musician. I went to San Francisco State, but we got a record deal in the middle of that. And so I was out of there quick.
Shout out to all the Golden Gators out there.
Yeah. And yeah. And so it was probably easier for me having done a career in art. And also, you know, I've been around music video sets. I know people who've made films in different ways. And so being an artist has made me honest with myself about my strengths and weaknesses, and honest with myself about what I do know and what I don't know. So I was able to identify those things and go out and find it and meet Guillermo del Toro at a luncheon and corner him and hound him until he gave me all the information I needed, or to get David Gordon Green to be a mentor and let me shadow him on when he went and shot stuff. So, you know, if someone that has built a house tells you they're going to build a boat, you'll believe them because they actually did something they said they were going to do. And so that helped me.
That's interesting. I was thinking about the beginning of the Coos career. And, you know, I caught on as a teenager a few years in. You already had a record deal and stuff. But when you got a record deal, it was basically the only time in the history of hip hop that lots of urban music artists from the Bay Area were getting big record deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were in the right place at the right time.
It was like MC Hammer had happened. MC Hammer had changed the face of hip hop,
mm-hmm,
coming from Oakland.
And Digital Underground was
there was Digital Too Underground, Short. There was Too Short, there was these other kind of corollary things.
And what the thing about business, especially entertainment and the music business, is people are not creative. So they're like, this worked. We don't know what the hell happened, but we do know that these three groups were from Oakland. So got any more Oakland groups?
I think a lot about this novelty record by the country novelty band Riders in the Sky, who are like a band that they're very lovely and charming, but they're like a band you would see at a state fair, or maybe on a Prairie Home Companion or something. And I had this tape of theirs as a kid that had this running joke where somebody would say, has it been done before? And the other guy would say, yeah, sure, millions of times. And then the business guy would say, great, we know it works. But what's wild about it to me is that, you know, you certainly couldn't have been more divergent aesthetically from Hammer. I like Hammer. I have no beef with Hammer. Yeah, but like,
we were very different from everybody. I mean, I think our first review that came out was by Danielle Smith, who then went on to be the editor of Essence, but then was just writing for the Bay Guardian. And she was like, sounds like Boots Riley is trying to find his style. And I think you could apply that to everything I do right now. And what she meant by that was there was no place to plug us in. Like, oh, you like this group? You'll love this. You'll love the coup. It was hard to do that. And it was only because Stu Fine at Wild Pitch is a crazy dude. And he may or may not have been able to capitalize to the best of his abilities on these groups that he signed. But he signed some amazing groups like Gangstar and Main Source and, you know, all these groups that other rappers love but may not have, you know, while they were on Wild Pitch, flourished as much. So we got found out by that label, and it was just kind of lucky for us.
Let's hear one of the records. This was like, I mean, in some ways, this is like one of the closest things to a hit you had in the very early part of your career. Mm-hmm. This is from your
second album, Genocide in Juice, from 1994, and it's called Fat Cat's Bigger Fish.
It's almost 10 o'clock, see I got a ball of lip for property, so I slip my beanie on slopper and promenade out to take up a collection. I got game like I read the directions. I'm wishing that I had an automobile as I feel the cold wind rush past. But let me state that I'm...
That's a story song. It's a great story song. And it seemed like you were very deeply committed from the beginning to that idea of narrative. That's not to say that all coup songs are narrative at all. Yeah. It was relatively few of them.
No, I love... It's just that I love that. One, I wanted to be a filmmaker, so the idea of being able to make someone see a film in their head while they're listening to the song was like, cool, this is much cheaper than making a movie. So that excited me. I also obviously was very influenced by Slick Rick and Ice Cube, things like that. So those were heroes, and wanted to do that as well. But yeah, story has always been a big part of things to me, and I think that's how, you know, as in meeting some organizers through my life growing up, the really effective ones were sometimes these very long-winded people who told a lot of personal stories that made you understand the concept.
I mean, my dad was a professional organizer for most of his life, and he's still alive. He's just retired. Yeah. And goodness knows, I went to plenty of events and protests and so on and so forth when I was a kid with him. And I think that narrative is a really essential part of organizing, not just in terms of one's own personal story, although that can be a really important part of it. But anytime you are trying to share a message, putting it in the context of a story, whether it's the story of an event, you know, I was just thinking of my dad's best friend helped organize a protest in favor of, or a demonstration in favor of, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was a bunch of folks who were partially paralyzed took their wheelchairs up to the stairs in front of Congress and got out of their wheelchairs and dragged themselves up the stairs, right? Mm-hmm. That's a story that they are telling.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so compelling that these, you know, it's only, whatever, 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what makes it so powerful.
Yeah. It's being able to cause empathy in the person that you're talking to, which allows them to see an analysis of the world through your eyes. And so, and also just, I'm just a fan of storytelling, and I'm a fan of, like, that story has, you know, it starts off one way and goes a whole different direction. So I always was a fan of taking people on that journey and taking those journeys myself.
You know, like Fat Cat's Bigger Fish, which is a story about some folks essentially getting together to rob rich people at a party. And it is tonally, you know, this is something that you made in 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It tonally really reminds me of Sorry to Bother You.
Huh.
Like there's, you know, Sorry to Bother You gets more intense than Fat Cat's Bigger Fish does.
Yeah.
It gets really intense.
Yeah.
But it has the same kind of freewheeling satirical quality that also encompasses, you know, kind of recognition of real humanity. And visual stuff, too. I mean, like, in that song is one of my favorite stanzas in a hip-hop record ever, which is, I would leave it to you to say because I'm no rapper. You'll be surprised to learn. But it's about the streetlight and the ground.
The streetlight reflects off the piss on the ground, which reflects off the hamburger sign turning around, which reflects off the chrome of the BMW, which reflects off the fact that I'm broke. Now what the f*** is new?
Right. And that is very plain. I mean, it's not like, it's not fancy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's nothing fancy about it. It's intensely visual.
Dave Eggers School of Writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah, that's the thing is, I mean, painting a picture, it's hard to talk about those things because I kind of don't know what I'm doing. you know, the whole time. I'm trying to find something to do. And the stuff that really works, I could try to break it down and be like, this is why it works. But you don't really know. You don't really, you know, you have ideas and those ideas keep you going. But, you know, I think once I worry that once I try to start qualifying exactly what I'm doing, that's when, you know, I'll get too in my head and not be able to do those things.
The first time I interviewed you for this show was, I don't know, a long time ago, let's say 15 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
And we talked about the rappers who influenced you.
Yeah.
You really talked a lot about Ice Cube,
mm-hmm.
who I think is, you know, it makes a lot of sense because Cube is funny and kind of plain and humane, and he's also, like, ferocious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought of Too Short, who raps about completely different stuff than what you rap about most of the time, mm-hmm. but also has that kind of plain quality, like it's declamatory, you know
and,
what I mean?
And that's something...
It's like an announcement.
Yeah. And that's something, yeah, there's songs that we have that are influenced by some of that style, and some of that is a little bit more of an identity thing for me because I'm in Oakland, so okay, let me do something that's like that, much like there might be a jazz musician from Mexico City that's like, okay, now we're going to do, you know, something that's ranchero style or whatever,
right.
You know, and you know, so I
it's like a piece of who you are. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Even as a guy from San Francisco, like I feel like there are these artists who are so deeply tied to where I'm from that they feel like a part of me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like rapping Forte went to my high school. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like that's
yeah.
It just means everything, that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I wonder is at the time that the coup was coming out, you know, Bay Area hip-hop and especially independent Bay Area hip-hop was moving in a much more abstract kind of super lyrical direction.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of... I mean,
oh, like,
there was...
like
there was
Hyro.
There was, yeah. I mean, there was also, you know, there was also a lane of, you know, mob music was really flourishing at the
mm-hmm.
time, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's all this kind of Hyro, you know, Souls and Dell and all this stuff that was super lyrical, and you never became super lyrical.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you ever if you ever thought, like, maybe I should make, like... maybe I should focus on like developing crazy styles.
Yeah. So to me, because I think of them more as style purveyors.
Right.
And to me, like super lyrical is like Nas.
Sure.
Or something
okay.
like that, which is different. And I definitely have aspired to
that the Nas
sort of thing. But Hyro, they kind of had this style that felt really lively and actually got picked up a lot, but it influenced hip hop in more ways than people think about. I was talking to Andre 3000 the other day and him talking about how much Souls of Mischief influenced them, you know, and I just dropped a big name, but that's cool.
No, that was like the best anecdote you possibly could have told me. Like, you really couldn't have hit a bigger home run with that name drop in this room. I don't know how NPR listeners feel about that, but...
Yeah. And there was a big thing that came out of Oakland that influenced a lot of style. But in my head, so in the movie, Cassius Green has this existential crisis that is there and I'm always in the midst of that. And I'm a lot of times writing my stuff thinking about people listening to it 100 years from now. And although there's no way to predict how that will be looked at, I am also thinking about how it's read, you know. So for me, it's not just an auditory thing.
I want to play a little bit of another great story record that you made. And this maybe is the one that I feel the most strongly about. And it's called Me and Jesus the Pimp in a 79 Granada Last Night. And this is from my guest Boots Riley's group The Coups album that came out in 1998, Steal This Album.
Z. city lights from far away can make you drop your jaw. Sparkling light sequins on the transvestite at Mardi Gras. There's beauty in the cracks of the cement. When I was five, I hopped over them wherever we went to prevent whatever it was that could break my mama's back. Little did I know that it would roll up in a Cadillac. And matter of fact, she couldn't see him like a cataract. And on the track, she went from beautiful to battle axe. And back at home, she would cry into her pillow, vomit in the
commode. This is a story about a young man whose dad gets out of jail, and they go for a drive together. And it's also, I mean, I think the first time I heard that song, I mean, 1998, so I was 17. And I think I heard it. It was right when the record came out, and I happened to be in this class with this guy, Ricky Vincent, who teaches at San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm. Uhuru Maggot.
Yeah, the Uhuru Maggot from KPFA Radio in Berkeley. And this class was not a hip hop class, but this song came out, and he's like, this record just came out. You got to hear this. And I remember sitting in this class. I'm 17. I'm surrounded by college students. I'm a junior in high school. And I'm just sitting there with all of these people who are, like, as far as I'm concerned, the coolest people in the world, because they're all 21. Mm-hmm. And I was just crying listening to this story. And because the story was so transporting, I think it took me a while to absorb its sort of allegorical content. You know, it becomes a story about the young man's mother and his relationship with his parents. And ultimately, I don't know if songs can have spoiler alerts, Boots, but it came out a long time ago.
You don't need a spoiler alert.
Ultimately, he kills his father.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you were thinking about when you were writing that song.
Honestly, this is probably one of my most, like, masturbatory sort of things, because I was just like, I want to write a good story. I want there to be all sorts of little things that you have to catch up on. Like, there's, you know,
I think it was like 5 years after this song came out that I talked to you about it the first time. And you're like, oh, you know, 79 Granada, that's because that's when the revolution was in Granada.
Well, that's what I thought. But this is when I wrote it. I really didn't have access to the internet. So it was really 81 that it happened.
Okay.
And but yeah, so that is, yeah, I have all sorts of little things in there that probably people won't pick up on unless they're really nerding out on it. And all sorts of references, and that sort of thing is fun to me. And I think maybe I do that in Sorry to Bother You as well in the movie. But yeah, I wanted to make something that was chock full of references and also had a larger allegory about the myth of black capitalism. Again, most people will hear it and it's just the story that happens, you know, and I also wanted to make something that got across something emotional. I think starting out, like, being all about lyrics, you can get really caught into these conventions that are supposed to mean you're a good lyricist, which are like similes and metaphors and being clever.
Similes that are usually puns more than they are similes. Like, they don't really bring a lot of clarity. Yeah. It's more just like a cute thing you said.
Yeah, exactly.
Which can be very cute. Shout out to Chino XL. Yeah. But like,
yeah, and it's all about being clever, which subtracts you from the emotion of art. You know, like, nobody wants a clever painter or a clever, you know, they want something that a piece that, you know, like, they don't want a sculpture that just makes you laugh. Oh, the dick is in the ear. That's cool. You know, they want something that is that
somebody in art school is writing that down real quick. Put in the ear.
Yeah. They, you know, so this was kind of an exercise at trying to figure out a story that could move me enough to translate that onto paper and pen and into a song to translate an emotion in there. And I think this was like the beginning of me being able to do that, which then did change my songwriting style to the chagrin of some of my fans and, you know, but to the delight of some people that became fans after that.
I think it's also a hip-hop record by a man about women that feels very full in the way that it embraces the problematic relationships between women and exploitative systems, and also men who participate in those exploitative systems in a way that's much fuller than, you know, there are a lot of hip-hop records by dudes about women are either misogynist or they're I love my mom. Like, yeah, great.
This is about,
love our mom. And I've honestly enjoyed hip-hop songs of both of those types.
I love your mom, too.
Thank you. Yeah, my mom's great.
Everybody loves, she's a teacher, and everyone seems to love her.
Yeah. But, like, that, I feel like from listening to the song, that was a choice you made, that you as a dude wanted to make a song about women that was richer than some of the other songs about women that were out
there. Yeah, I think that, well, I didn't approach it from that standpoint, but I guess my my standpoint is that sexism and patriarchy affect women the most, but oppressing women makes men's life worse as well. Like, what effect does living in a world like that have on you, on your personality, on your soul? I'm saying that you living in a world where masculinity is defined by oppressing women,
violence and dominance, and
is not a full world, and you kill part of yourself. And so that was the point of it, is that it's not, we shouldn't just be against these things because we're against the oppression of women. We should also be against them because we want to live life to its fullest and be as free as possible.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Boots Riley fronts the rap group The Coup. He also wrote and directed the film Sorry to Bother You.
What was it like for you when, as the years went by, and The Coup was in many ways what you would call a band, but it was also a hip-hop group, which is to say that initially it was the three of you. It was Pam the Funkstress DJing, E-Rock, and you emceeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, after a few years, E-Rock left and went and got a job. I remember, I don't know if this is actually true, but I remember that I feel like it. Everybody would say, oh, yeah, he works at FedEx now.
No, he became a longshoreman.
Oh, there you go. So that's a good job.
Yeah, it's like $100,000.
Yeah, that's
like,
a dude. I was about to say FedEx is a good job because I had an aunt did great working at FedEx. But
the confusion is that he and I met while working at UPS.
Oh, okay. There we go.
It was me, him, and Spice One. Loading up bellies.
That's a pretty killer lineup.
Yeah. And we would hide from the managers in the bellies of the planes and rap.
So he left the group after a couple of years. And then after many years, she has since passed away. But after many years, Pam the Funkstress, your DJ, essentially left the group to have a job, to run a business. She was a catering business.
What it was is she was always... She always was running a business. She bought the place that she was working for. She worked out a deal with them and bought it in like 98. So she was already doing that for a while. But her business paid way more than going out on tour with us. And she tried to go out on tour with us and let a family member run it while we were on tour. And she almost lost the business. So she was like, I'm not doing that again.
So what was it like to you to think, you've always had these big dreams about what The Coup is, more than just a band, I think. You know, you've always seen it as a way to communicate a message and move a movement.
Yeah.
What was it like to you to lose these friends in this effort to reasons that were... very reasonable reasons, like not reasons that you could object to.
Yeah. No, I mean, with E-Rock, it just totally made sense. It didn't feel like a knock or a blow. And, you know, I still communicate with E-Rock. Matter of fact, we did a lot of work with the longshoremen during the Occupy movement. You know, he always was a reluctant member in the first place because he was my friend from UPS. And one day, New Year's Eve, going into 1991, I was like, whatever studio is open tomorrow that will answer the phone on New Year's Eve and they're open tomorrow, I'm taking my money and I'm making this music that I said I was going to make. And got the guy to answer the phone, and then I realized I only had enough to pay for the studio, didn't have even bus fare after that. And so I called my friend E-Rock up, who had a car. And, you know, because at the time I was driving this moped, and so I had to bring records to the studio. There was no, you know. And so he came, and on the way there, I was like, man, you should be in the group too. And he was like, okay. And that's how he got in the group. And throughout the whole time, he was just kind of like, you know, like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing. But so it was a lot easier for him to do something else.
You and Pam had been partners for 20 years.
I mean, I think as far as just talking about the impact of not working with different people, I think that I'm so stuck on getting the next thing done that it just goes immediately into problem-solving mode. I'm not really mourning the past of what happened. I'm more like, okay, this is how we're gonna have to get this next thing done. And, you know, just the way that we worked a lot of times was that I'd do an album and Pam would come in at the end and lay the scratches down. And so it definitely was a change in kind of the feeling of who we were and who we like kind of identified as. I think there's something about that in life too. Like you just keep pushing and you have all this work to do and you don't really have time to, you know, maintain friendships or be with family enough, and there's all of this stuff. And so I've lived this life of doing that. Like decades go past and you're just working to try to make this thing happen. And that's kind of maybe why the coup has, like, we never got hooked in nostalgia, because it would be easy. Like, there's a lot of groups that came out when we did that are just touring based on, we're from the 90s, you like the 90s now, you know what I'm saying? And I never was interested in doing that because we never blew up, I knew that maybe blowing up was on the horizon and, you know, didn't pay attention to what people said about this or that. And so my music was always about here and now, and our sets were always about here and now. We weren't like, here's the songs, you know, we were like, we got this new shit you're gonna love, you know. And it was more like, okay, these are the factors we're dealing with, we're going on. It wasn't really like a sentimental connection to what I thought the coup was. You know, there was like, it's like people come up to me with tattoos of the coup logo. I mean, it's cool, but they're often like, where's yours? Obviously, you have one. I'm like, you know, I'm not that committed to this group. I don't know, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
It's only 25 years, you know? 27
yeah.
years.
You know, yeah, yeah.
You must have had to think about what the group meant in a retrospective way when Pam got sick.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were, you know, because you were still the public figure in the group,
mm-hmm.
you were kind of the conduit of information about her illness when she was really sick. And I imagine that you must have absorbed a lot of stories about the meaning of her work to people, and by extension, your work to people.
Yeah. It's hard for me to feel like, wow, I really did that or anything like that about the stuff that I've done, because the goal of the movement that I want to see is so much greater than people liking the music, you know? Like, for me, it's like, check, good. Now there's this other thing. So emotionally, I'm glad that people connected to the music, and it means a lot to me. But it's not in a way that you would think would be satisfying. Like,
do you let yourself feel satisfied about anything?
No, I don't think I do. I just,
because you're in middle age, you're allowed to be happy about some things now.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for me to. I have never taken a vacation. I've been a lot of places and had a lot of fun, but it's always the only way I can have fun is if there's some reason that I'm there, some reason that I'm doing it. And I think, you know, that's valid. Like, you want, there's some people who, you know, maybe work a tech job in which that their job was doing art and engaging with people in different places. And so my work is not, I'm not lifting boxes or anything like that. But, you know, so there is something to be said for that. But I think being on stage and showing this movie, I sit through a lot of screenings of the movie and seeing people, and sometimes, you know, I'll get asked, oh, are you going to sit through the screening? I'm like, oh, hell yeah. People are, this is my work, and I get to see people interacting with it. At those moments, that feels like the closest to satisfaction. Oh, this worked. Or even when it's like not working or something like that, it feels like an engagement, and that's the closest thing that I feel to satisfaction.
We'll finish up my interview with Boots Riley when we return from a break. He'll tell me that even though he advocates for change in all of his creative work, he doesn't think that art alone can start a revolution. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The coronavirus pandemic is changing everything really fast. So we have created a podcast where you can hear conversations and stories from NPR journalists who are covering the pandemic, the public health fight against it, and how the world is coping. I'm your host, Kelly McEvers. Listen and subscribe to Coronavirus Daily from NPR.
We are the host of My Brother and Me, and now, nearly 10 years into our podcast, the secret can be revealed. All the clues are in place, and the world's greatest treasure hunt can now begin.
Embedded in each episode of My Brother and Me is a micro clue that will lead you to 14 precious gemstones all around this big, beautiful blue world of ours.
So start combing through the episodes. Let's say starting at episode 101 on.
Yeah, the early episodes are pretty problematic, so there's no clues in those episodes.
No, not at all.
The better ones, the good ones, clues ahoy.
Listen to every episode repeatedly in sequence. Laugh if you must, but mainly get all the great clues. My Brother and Me, it's an advice show, kind of, but a treasure hunt, mainly. Anywhere you find podcasts or treasure maps, My Brother and Me, the hunt is on.
It's Bullseye, I'm Jesse Thorne. We're listening to my conversation with the great Boots Riley. He wrote and directed the film Sorry to Bother You. It's an absurd, brilliant story about telemarketing, capitalism, monsters, and more. He also fronts the legendary Bay Area rap group, The Coup. Let's get back into our conversation.
You talked about the way that in your lyrics you tried to have emotional connections to people's problems in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that you're as good as anyone there is at drawing connections between kind of real human stories and problematic systems. And a song that, you know, another one on the very short list of rap songs that make Jesse cry. Like, it's a real, I've loved hip hop my whole life, and like, it's a real short list. There's a lot more songs that make me want to party. Is a song called Underdogs,
That's from that same record, 1998. Let's take a listen to it.
There's certain tricks of the trade to try to halt your feet, like taking Tupperware to win all you can eat. Returning you ish for news saying you lost your receipt and writing four-figure checks when your accounts deplete. Then all your problems pile up about a mile up, thinking about a partner you could dial up to help you out the foul stuff. Whole family sleeping on the futon while you clipping coupons, eating salad trying to get full off the crouton.
What's interesting to me is you have these songs that are so specific and so humane, but very rarely, especially for an MC, but for a songwriter in general, very rarely are you writing about yourself from a first-person perspective.
Yeah. It's interesting because that one, to a certain extent, was. I started that song. I had a friend who actually appeared on a couple Coup albums. He went by the name Point Blank Range. And he died recently, like a couple years ago. But something had happened where he had kind of scammed my father out of a couple $100s. And this was somebody that we had helped a lot, like, you know, not only with his music and stuff like that. And, you know, I started out writing like a diss song, like about it. And just while writing that, thinking about his life, this is a guy who had, when he was a kid, got burned and covered in burns and lived, you know, it's hard to even talk about it. But anyway, this is a song that came out of that. And the reason that it's hard is because he died recently. And he kind of lived hustling and sometimes betrayed his friends. And this was me writing a song that came from an understanding of a whole situation that he was in, and that came first from a point of disgust, and ended up with this song. So definitely is really personal, and is one of the only songs that I do a cappella. So, and I had actually forgot about the origin of it until like years and years later.
That you have been feeling this anger towards this friend who had stuck it to your dad, and that had led you to think about those circumstances that you recognized.
Yeah, definitely. And he was a really good rapper too. He's on the Coup song Kill My Landlord. He's on what's that other one? Interrogation.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. Here with me now is Boots Riley.
So in the movie, you have two main characters, one of whom is going through extraordinary financial success as a salesman and has to deal with the implications of that for his community, his peer group, the labor movement that he leaves behind as he becomes more and more rich, and also what he's selling. And an artist who is his girlfriend, who is dealing with her feelings about the value of what she does and dealing with, you know, there's some ambivalence in the film about like what is the impact and value of art as well. Was that something that you just, were those ideas just ones that you had been working in your hands, like smoothing a river
stone? Those are the ideas that I'm struggling with all the time, you know, and to a certain extent, every you know, there's Stevie in Place Squeeze, who's a union organizer, and Jermaine Fowler plays Sal, who's kind of like always making light of things. They're all like parts of me. And the problems that they're dealing with are ones that I'm always questioning myself about. And is this effective? How do I make it more effective? And on the Cassius side, what does it all mean? How do I make use of this time that I'm here? How do I make it important? And so all of these are things that are running through my mind at all times.
That's a lot of load to bear. I mean, that's something that I personally struggle with too. And I try and check myself once in a while and say, like, it is okay to, like, leave the world better than you found it. You don't have to transform the world personally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's okay that, like, you know, I do a really dumb comedy show that's not about anything, right? Mm. On that really dumb comedy show that's not about anything, I do have to occasionally remind myself, like, once in a while somebody is really sick or their mom is really sick and they're driving home and they, you know, send me an email and they say, I just wanted to have something that made me feel nice for 20 minutes. I kind of have to remind myself. But, like, if you are always looking at the top of the mountain, changing the world, which I know you believe really strongly in changing the world.
Yeah.
You know, revolution has always been your explicit goal, right? A monumental change.
Yep.
That's a lot to carry as a person.
Well, yeah. And the problem is that no one person is supposed to carry it. And that's the reason for organizations is because no one is going to change anything on their own, which is kind of the fallacy about art, is like, I can make this thing that will change the world. It's not even effective if you're not connected with people that are doing things that cause a material change in the distribution of wealth, honestly. You know, this idea that's out there of, like, just let your voice be heard and that's enough. Is also leads to this immense pressure on one person, like, because yes, individually we're not effective at doing anything, really. Like, we really can't even feed ourselves individually. You know, it takes a lot of people to get food onto our plate, you know. So changing the world, and by that I mean making a world in which, and in my mind, this is what I'm talking about, making a world in which the people democratically control the wealth that we create with our labor. Making a world in that way is not something that's going to happen from one artist saying the right thing. I think that the key is, and often that's how activism is approached as well. It's like, there's a thing, let's go to it. There's this other thing, let's go to it. People not necessarily having the time and organizations not approaching it from the sense of building an organization that can help each other to do these things. And so some of those pressures and some of those worries come from the amount of work that it takes for me to make things and I don't write very fast. I don't, you know, do anything very fast. So my way of working, if I'm going to actually produce these pieces of art, is one that does not really allow me to do a lot else, which is why the times when I've gotten involved in stuff, I've had to quit doing music or doing art of any kind. So it ends up being isolating, not only politically, but with family and friends, because it takes a lot more work. And I wouldn't be doing it if I only allotted 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day to doing it. I'm always working. I'm always feeling like, you know, one reason I like movies is because I can just finally escape and be okay with not with the things that I'm not getting done right now.
Not that your movie allows for that much escape. I'm like you really keep people on target.
Yeah. Well, I also,
with the tonal evolution of the film.
Exactly. Yeah, I wanted to make a movie that kept you engaged, not like, you know, there are definitely movies where you can, where you know the structure, and they're good movies partially because you know the structure and the beats within what the director is dancing in, and you can see what they do with that. But this is one where I think the structure hopes to keep you engaged and on your toes. You're not going to think, oh, right about here is where I can go to the bathroom. You're going to understand from it, like, you might go to the bathroom and you're going to miss a very good part of this. So go to the bathroom before you see the movie. And so I wanted to keep people engaged with that, to give that feeling of that hopefully life brings. And I know I've kind of been painting more of a bleaker picture of life in this interview, but you know, that it's,
well, it's
excitement.
A very joyful movie. I mean, it's about really scary things about the world, but it's a joyful film.
Yeah.
Boots, I got to tell you this, you know, as a guy who made art that was really important to me as a teenager, when you found a new lane, you know, nothing's more important than the art that was important to you as a teenager. And when you found a new lane, I was like, oh, no. This guy I admire is going to do something I really don't like, and it's really going to bum me out.
Like Graffiti Bridge.
Absolutely. And I went to your movie, and man, did it deliver. So I feel like proud of you for blossoming in this new medium, and I'm so glad that you took the time to come back and be on the show. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you, man. Thanks a lot. Glad you liked it.
Boots Riley, Sorry to Bother You is a great film, an instant classic. It's streaming right now on Hulu. It's available to rent or buy pretty much anywhere else. I can't recommend it highly enough. It is a mind blower. It is hilarious and insightful and at times kind of terrifying. It's a great movie. If you haven't checked out The Coup before, maybe start with their album from 1998, Steal This Album. I might be recommending that only because it's the one that I started with when I was 17, but is a truly exceptional record featuring Me and Jesus the Pimp, the story song that we talked about in this conversation, that I think is maybe the best story song in hip-hop history. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is currently being produced out of the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Los Angeles, California. This is normally where we would do an update on what's going on in MacArthur Park, but none of us have been to MacArthur Park this week. So an update on what's going on in my house. My son, Curtis, woke us up at 5:30 in the morning the other day to tell us about a dream he had about his brother, Oscar. He said, "Mommy, I have a sad feeling. I had a dream, and Oscar was wearing a helmet that was a sandwich." Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, a.k.a. DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And we have decades of interviews in our archives. If you need a friend because you're self-isolating this week, why not go to MaximumFun.org and scroll through the Bullseye page, or open up Bullseye in your favorite podcast app and take a look for a name that jumps out at you. If you liked this interview with Boots Riley of The Coup, he's been on before. I do love Boots and love The Coup.
We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can keep up with the show there. And know that we at Bullseye are thinking of you. It's tough times out there, and our hearts are with all of you, and we're grateful that we're able to connect with you in this unusual way. Anyway, I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.